Blog Talk Radio.
He could do a 95 running coast to coast. You had Norm Van Brocklin, a real great player, so swift with his moves that he could be mayor. Why ain't Tittle, Ally Madison? Hey, I remember all those guys from back in the day.
It's the sport of games, better than diamond ring.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the CMT Firestorm Football Show. We are live from the CMT Firestorm Studios in Tampa, Florida. I'm your host, Carson Mathis, where the theme of the show is to give raw, uncut, and unedited objective analysis on major college and professional football. Tonight, I'm going to get right into it. Most of us have heard about the Penn State sexual molestation scandal with Jerry Sandusky, and he was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison on Monday of this week. The Penn State scandal has opened the country's eyes to the culture of sexual sports today. So for the first 30 minutes of the show, we have Dr. Nick Pappas, a former collegiate and professional ice hockey player and coach who earned a doctorate degree in human development, family science, sociology, sport from the Ohio State University. This unique background, in combination with his experience as a sports researcher, professional counselor, personal athletic life coach, and college professor, have given Dr. Pappas a distinct vantage point into both social and athletic behavioral issues that are highlighted in this one-of-a-kind book titled The Dark Side of Sports, Exposing the Sexual Culture and of Collegiate and Professional Athletes. Let me welcome, without further ado, Dr. Nick Pappas. Dr. Pappas.
Good evening, and thanks for having me on your show tonight.
Thank you. So the first question I want to ask you is, what inspired you to write a book on the sexual culture of elite-level athletes?
Well, during my career as a collegiate and professional athlete, being in that culture, it puts you in contact with and makes you aware of certain sexually deviant behaviors that are often thriving on different teams. They're the seedier, sleazier type of things that go on. They're not always illegal or aggressive in nature, but they fly under the radar oftentimes, and they soil the athlete cultures, and they victimize others. Could be victimizing athletes in terms of hazing incidences, and usually more so than not, they're targeting females in the process. And so, during my research for my doctorate degree, I knew about this stuff long before I ever studied it. And while I was interviewing guys for the out-of-sport aggression that was happening in the bar fights, targeting females with aggression, I thought, hey, the real story here is the sexual deviancy that's flying under the radar. It's not getting reported in the media. It's thriving in a lot of athlete cultures. And a number of athletes that I interviewed said, hey, I wanted to write a book like this, and I'm probably not going to get around to it, so I'm going to help you by being interviewed. And so, having known things, seen things during my collegiate professional career as an athlete and coach, you know things, you see things. You know what goes on. You see things. And, this is a story that had to be told. It took 12 years to write, and, the timing was right in line with the Penn State scandal by accident.
All right. Well, my next question is, what were the biggest challenges you faced during the writing of this book?
You know, it was a long-term project, as I noted. It took 12 years to do. And the interviews encompassed about 142 athletes from five major sports, basketball, baseball, football, wrestling, and hockey. So I have major leaguers, minor leaguers, collegiate players, and some Olympians in the sample as well. And so the biggest challenge, I would say, is getting major leaguers to talk to you about these issues. And the reason is they'd been burned oftentimes or misquoted by journalists, and so they were very hesitant to talk to anybody. They feared that their name would be attached to certain things and it would, come back to haunt them in some way. And so, having the athletic background that I did, in addition to the doctorate degree, that helped me to show them by giving them a previous study that I'd done with collegiate professional athletes that I'd coached. And I showed them, hey, look at how the words are used. There's no names, there's no teams, there's no identifying information. And as a result, that helped to break down the barriers. But, getting them to trust me that, I wasn't going to use their name. Now, there are names mentioned in my book, The Dark Side of Sports, but that's more when it appears as public record. It's in a magazine already. It's in a book. It's in the newspaper. But the guys that talked to me were guaranteed confidentiality, and anything that they said would never be linked to an identity, a team, or things like that. So I think that was the most challenging thing, getting the major leaguers to trust you, because, again, I'm asking questions that you wouldn't tell your best friend in some cases.
True that. What do your findings in the book have in common with the Penn State scandal?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the thing that comes to mind first is the reoccurring theme that there's a lot of cover-ups going on among coaches and administrators. They're looking the other way when a lot of sexual deviancy is going on. And as a result, it gives these behaviors a green light to continue when coaches aren't disciplining their players for these actions or administrators aren't taking the steps to make sure these aren't happening in the different athletic teams. It basically gives a green light for them to continue. And basically, when coaches aren't holding people accountable or giving consequences that are just a slap on the wrist, they may be giving consequences that are different for the third string athlete versus the star on the team. It becomes a joke. Some coaches are looking the other way to the point where they can say, hey, I didn't know what was going on, because they're not trying to find out what's going on. So they're honest when they're saying they didn't know what was going on. And, it just allows these behaviors to continue. But a reoccurring theme in the book is the guys I talked to said, hey, coaches, it's either a slap on the wrist or they didn't want to know or they didn't have a clue. Some coaches did know, but there's a definitely reoccurring theme of cover-ups, looking the other way, ignoring the situation, which just allows it to continue.
Okay. Are there specific sports and levels that were represented? Basically the question is, what specific sports and levels were represented and discussed in the book?
Well, as I noted, the five major sports, basketball, baseball, football, wrestling, and hockey, were represented. 142 athletes in all, representing the major league, minor league of professional sports, collegiate level, and Olympians were involved. And I think one of the big to-dos with this book was, while the book focused on collegiate and professional athletes' sexual deviancy and aggression, every single sexually deviant or aggressive behavior that I found occurring at this level also occurred at the high school level. So that's a huge message for parents right there, because this stuff starts in high school and is occurring just as – it's more rampant at the collegiate professional level, but the fact that I found it among numerous sports at the high school level is a huge message in and of itself.
Okay. What is athletes' sexual deviancy, and how does it differ from athletes' sexual aggression?
Well, that's a great question. I like to consider sexual deviancy or sexually deviant behaviors, more of the dirtier, seedier behaviors that involve sex, the perverted, squalid stuff. They're demeaning. They're harmful. They're not always against the law. They're very harmful. They tarnish our athlete cultures, and they take a toll on personal and team reputations. And while sexual deviancy is not always illegal, it can easily act as stepping stones to sexual aggression. So, you know, when you hear the word deviant, well, it's deviating from the accepted standards of behavior. But some of the behaviors that I came across and found are normal for some of these athlete cultures. So when we're talking about things like rampant promiscuity, sex in the recruiting process, voyeurism, video voyeurism, group sex, you know, these can be normal occurrences depending on the team.
Well, the next question is, what kinds of athlete sexual deviancies were most surprising to you then?
Well, I think first it had to be maybe the competitions and contests to have sex with women, where about 75% of my guys knew about this stuff during their career. A third were participating in it. And so it could be how many females we're going to hook up. We're going to have a contest or competition to hook up with how many females in a 24-hour period or perhaps a week or a semester. It could be on road trips. It could be targeting females with different physical characteristics, blondes, brunettes, redheads. Some of the crueler contests involve the heavier set females that guys would target to have sex with. Some of the competitions could involve different types of sexual behaviors, anal sex, group sex, you name it was going on. And some of these competitions had elaborate spreadsheets, point systems, charts, and, you know, so some of them were informal, but some of them were very formal. Another very, very disturbing behavior was the voyeurism that goes on, where guys would actually set up a situation where they would have their buddies staked out in a room so that when they'd come in to hook up with a female, the buddies were already in there watching the situation from the closet, under the bed, hidden in the room. But it's extremely prevalent, again, just like the competitions, because 75%, again, knew this was going on, and a third participated in these situations as well. But it doesn't stop at just watching the situations, because guys then are sometimes videotaping these situations, which can be extremely harmful when they end up on the Internet or things like that. And, you know, so these non-consensual videotaping that was going on. And some of the athletes had said one out of two of these instances, guys are trying to join the sexual situation, sometimes unbeknownst to the female. So if she's intoxicated or it's very dark, she sometimes doesn't know she's being switched up upon. Sometimes these situations can result in group sex, which was extremely common. 95% of the guys I talked to knew about this stuff during their career. A third participated. But of that third that participated, 70% of the group said that they had experience with a larger group situation, meaning more than three people, and it could be as many as 15-on-1 in some cases. So the problem with this is, These so-called gangbangs, these trains, these foursomes, fivesomes, what guys are calling group sex, oftentimes is group sexual assault because the female's intoxicated. And any time a female has any amount of alcohol in her during sexual intercourse, it's a non-consensual sexual encounter because the drugs and alcohol, even if freely consumed, have taken away her ability to give mindful consent to these situations. And so, therefore, some of these group sex situations readily crossed the line into group sexual assaults. And so those were among the more disturbing, the targeted females. When you want to talk about athletes' hazing incidences and initiations, well, that's a whole other story as far as how they're targeting each other with an array of disturbing sexual practices, male-to-male stuff.
How common is this? How common, I think you sort of briefly, how common is the attitude athlete sexual deviancy based on your findings?
Well, you know, I interviewed guys that had competed in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, right to 2010 and beyond. And I found no difference in the types of sexually deviant behaviors that were going on, the practices, as well as how often this was going on. So extremely common, and you know, some of the guys that I talked to, you know, they said this is a weekly occurrence on certain teams that they'd been on, whether it was the competitions, the voyeurism, the group sex, you know, you name it. You know, this stuff could be happening on a weekly basis depending on the team. And so extremely prevalent in some of the athletes' experiences, and that's what's alarming. It began, you know, right from the 60s through 2010 and beyond, and you know, you can't address what you don't know is going on, and with so many coaches not wanting to know what's going on and address these things, you know, that's giving it a green light, essentially.
Well, okay, so I guess my follow-up question now is, like, what are some of the underlying causes of the athlete's sexual deviancy and or aggression?
Well, you know, you can't just say, hey, here's the cause. We take care of this one factor, and we're going to be set, and we're gonna wipe this phenomenon out. It doesn't work like that because there's multidimensional influences kind of converge together, which enable these practices to occur. The first I'll talk about is this thing called athlete privilege. It's the attitude that, hey, I'm a star, I'm successful, do you know who I am? You know, nobody tells me what to do, I make the rules. And so it leads to a kind of a sense of entitlement that athletes can do what they want. They are put on heightened pedestals as it is. And, you know, there's a lot of hero worship that goes along with people in the athlete culture at the elite levels. At the same time, there's also an absence of deterrence, or what's called a lack of consequences, because, as I said, you know, administrators are not disciplining them for these actions. Sometimes they don't even want to know what's going on. So they can say, hey, I didn't know what was going on with these guys, and it allows these behaviors to continue. Another aspect and influence that promotes this stuff is what we call masculinity, or these manliness displays, where, you know, it's about sex with females is going to produce a lot of good stories, a lot of humor, a lot of entertainment. One athlete I interviewed said, hey, about 85% of the deviancy he saw was fueled by storytelling in the locker room the next day, because it's very status-producing. It gives you bragging rights. It gives you, you know, the bravado, and it's big entertainment. Athletes are very competitive, too, so they're trying to one-up each other and have a better story than the next guy. They're trying to outdo and outperform each other, and unfortunately, as soon as the lights turn off at the game or the practice is over, women become the next sport the guys are competing for. And, you know, you add the component of alcohol consumption, which is huge in the athlete culture. And we're not talking about just a six-pack here. You know, we're talking about 15 to 20 drinks, and guys are doing things that they would never do sober, because alcohol reduces the inhibitions, allowing sexually deviant and aggressive behaviors to thrive. Now you add a component called sexually available females. In The Dark Side of Sports, my book, I have a chapter on this, because females are making themselves available in unimaginable ways to athletes. Not that sexual deviancy wouldn't happen if they weren't, but this makes it so much easier. So, you know, the females who are following teams and want to have sexual encounters have no idea the different ways they will be targeted by groups of athletes who are acting as sexual predators when they make themselves available. And then, finally, some of these practices that athletes are doing do, in fact, lead to sexual obsessions, compulsions, and addictions. And guys had talked about their own struggles with this, as well as observing teammates who had seemingly sexual addictions in a number of different areas as well. So it's not one single influence where we can say, hey, let's wipe this out by taking care of this factor. No, it's a number of situations converging, as I just discussed.
Yes, I guess that's my following question. I guess, how do you go about addressing and preventing these sexual deviancies or aggressions?
Well, anytime you're talking about prevention, the first step in this, which is the purpose of my presentations to athletes, coaches, teachers, parents, and the purpose of the book, The Dark Side of Sports, also, is to raise awareness to these issues, to let people know what's going on, let people know what's been silently thriving in athletic teams from high school right up through the pros. You can't address what you don't know is happening, and the first step is finding out what's going on. And this is why this book the material in this book has never been in print before. It took 12 years to put together and to do. So very, very extensive. But, you know, the presentations and the books' purpose is to raise awareness to this stuff so that people do have the awareness that, hey, this stuff is going on. Okay, now we need to make sure it's not going on the teams that maybe we're coaching, or maybe that our sons are participating in, or things like that. Another important aspect of prevention is the idea of promoting the importance of cleaning up teams and sports cultures, promoting this thing called excellence, both on and off the playing field. You know, athletes have these great bonds and camaraderie. Well, you got to get this this notion that, hey, you know, we're not gonna let this go on our team. If we see somebody involved in some of this stuff, we're gonna make sure it stops. So it's about athletes policing their own, so to speak. So coaches and athletes learn to step up and take some leadership when they encounter negative practices. It's not turning our backs, looking the other way, or just watching, which is a reoccurring theme among athletes that I talk to, and numerous situations where guys, you know, were in position to stop assaults on passed out females, group sexual assaults, and they just watched. And, you know, that's unacceptable. Somebody's daughter is being victimized in this case, and it's not acceptable to just turn our heads and watch the situation or walk away. So it's about athletes policing their own and promoting this thing called excellence, not only in sports, but out of sports as well, from a variety of aspects of the self, in addition to the group dynamics. So that's you know, it's encouraging and teaching athletes to step up and take a stand against this stuff when it's observed. And, you know, it's about changing the athlete culture and getting guys to say, you know, you can't do this. This is wrong. And if nobody's ever told them this is wrong, well, let me be the first to let you know that, you know, these behaviors are wrong. They're victimizing others. They're soiling the athlete cultures. They give athletes a bad reputation, teams a bad reputation, and it needs to stop because it's going on too long. And if the Penn State scandal has done anything good, it's basically to open up people's eyes to say, look at what can be going on and being covered up from high-ranking officials, very influential people that you would never think would try to cover up situations. And in the Sandusky Penn State scandal, it was targeting young boys, victimizing young boys.
All right, I got a few more questions here. The first question is, who is going to benefit from reading this book?
Well, first and foremost, it's going to be people in the athlete culture that are the coaches, the managers, the administrators, and the athletes themselves, because there's a big message for them in this book. And, again, beginning at the high school level, this stuff needs to be addressed right through the college and the pro levels, because it's happening in all levels, sometimes at the collegiate and professional levels in a rampant fashion. So huge message there for those in the athlete culture. And then at the same time, there's a huge message for parents, because this stuff begins at the high school level, so parents need to talk to their athletes and say, hey, this stuff is going on different teams. Make sure it's not going on in your team, or if it does, make sure you alert people. You want to tell your parents. You want to let the people that are on the coaching staff know about this, as well as administrators, so that it can stop. And it is challenged. It just doesn't get swept under the carpet and go unattended, so to speak. Also, there's a big message for parents who have daughters, because the daughters are targeted by toxic behaviors beginning in high school, and parents and females would have no idea the different ways they could be targeted by these charismatic, fun-loving athletes that are very popular, and no one is going to expect them to be sexual predators doing the type of things that were revealed in the book, The Dark Side of Sports. And then there's a message there for just the sports enthusiasts or students who are interested in seeing what's going on behind the scenes at the elite level, as well as the high school level of sports as well. So I think there's a number of different populations that the book is written for, and it was in fact written in such a way that, you know, it's a book for the general population, in addition to those that are interested in studying this stuff.
Okay. How do athletes target young women and sometimes each other?
Well, I did mention and talk about how athletes are targeting each other how athletes are targeting young women through the competitions, tallying their sexual conquests, competing with that through the voyeurism, through the video voyeurism, group sex, group sexual assault. And a lot of this stuff, a lot of the sex also targets passed out females. So, and athletes will wait till somebody passes out, and then they'll look to have sex with, and it isn't sex, it's rape at this point, raping females who are passed out individually and in group situations. Now, the way that they're targeting other male athletes that are on their team, which, you know, I found hazing and initiations, about 80% of the guys knew about these situations on their college and pro teams, and 45% of the guys said, you know, these were involved, there was a lot of nudity and sexualized hazing rituals or practices going on pertaining to this stuff. So it could be things like genital shaving, body shaving, putting eight guys into the bathroom on the back of the bus naked and throwing their clothes in and making them come out after they have to untie their clothes. It can be tying up somebody naked, putting them in public places. You know, and as recently as this past summer and in September, I came across at the high school level, there was a situation, a hazing incident in Nebraska with wrestlers where there was a sodomizing incident with this hazing incident. And actually, it was alleged that the administrators who were both the coaches, principal, and supposedly the superintendent tried to cover this up. A similar sodomizing incident went on in the summer. There were charges brought up against a couple football, basketball players in Minnesota, and, you know, one got 20 charges, counts against him for sodomizing teammates in similar hazing incidences. So these situations go on with initiations. Some of the things that I found in revealed in the first chapter of The Dark Side of Sports had to do with deviant masturbation practices where guys are competing to see who can ejaculate first. Or if a guy passes out, they're looking to ejaculate on the guy as a kind of a prank to make him look bad. A lot of exhibitionist practices. So these kind of things, about a third of my guys that I interviewed had awareness of these kind of things. And it's almost a type of homoerotic type of behavior that could be very prevalent within certain teams as guys are targeting each other with an array of disturbing sexualized practices that sometimes are involved with hazing initiations, but sometimes it's just guys trying to be goofy and see who could make somebody else look bad with these behaviors.
All right, well, this is my last question. Our 30 minutes is almost up. What do parents and coaches need to know about athletes' sexual behaviors, motives, and consequences?
You know, I think the big message there is a lot of this stuff is happening because of groups of guys, peer groups, that are getting into deviant practices and interests, and this stuff is happening because guys are playing off of each other. They're trying to compete. They're trying to one-up each other. And, you know, it's kind of women become the proving ground or to try to do something that's more outrageous than the next guy. And it's for the stories. It's for the, you know, the bonding experiences. We're going to do this because, hey, it's not about having sex with a female. It's about having sex with a female and six of my best buddies, this kind of stuff. So a lot of these practices are happening because of the group and peer influences. And while I highlight this in the athlete culture, similar behaviors have been found in the military groups, in fraternities, in certain bands. Anywhere there's tight male bonding and guys get into deviant interests, this is where these behaviors can be found. And so that's a big message for parents, coaches. You know, look for the deviant groups of guys that are into stuff, and they're trying to take it to the limit, go over the top with this kind of stuff, and that's where it needs to be nipped in the bud.
Well, very, very interesting information here. Very, very interesting. The name of his book, Dr. Pappas, is The Dark Side of Sports, Exposing the Sexual Culture of Collegiate and Professional Athletes. if you need to contact Dr. Pappas, where can anyone who needs to contact you for the listeners, where can they contact you, or where can they get the book from?
My website, www.drnickpappas.com, has extensive information about the book, The Dark Side of Sports. It has links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The book can be purchased from virtually any bookseller. The website also gives information for parents on addressing sexual deviancy with their kids. And the website also gives information about my presentations that are meant to help clean up the athlete culture and addresses athletes, coaches, administrators, as well as teachers and parents. www.drnickpappas.com, and the book is The Dark Side of Sports, Exposing the Sexual Culture of Collegiate and Professional Athletes.
Well, thank you, Dr. Pappas. We will have the information, your website, and links to get to your book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We'll have it on the CMT Firestorm Facebook page and the website. Again, we would like to thank you. On behalf of CMT Firestorm, we'd like to thank you for appearing on the show. If there's any questions or any comments you'd like to make, you're more than welcome to do so. Now we're going to take a break, though. We're going to let Dr. Pappas go, and we're going to go into our regular analysis. Again, Dr. Pappas, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on your show tonight.
You're welcome. All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so now we're going to take a break, and we're going to put the panel on, and we're going to discuss what Dr. Pappas said. If anybody has any questions or comments, or anybody has anything they want to say, you want to call in, you're welcome to do so. We're going to take about a four-minute break. So we will get back in touch. We will get back online in 4 minutes. The CMT Firestorm. If you want to call in, 347-237-5539. CMT Firestorm.
Then I'ma go and get my Louis Vuitton. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm really such a lady. I've got young money, you know, Slim, baby. And we be doing donuts while we raving at the 80. We give a lot of money to the babies out in Haiti. Yelling all around the world, do you hear me? Do you like my body? Anna Nikki. Rest in peace to Anna Nicole Smith. Yes, my dear, you're so explosive. Say hi to Mary, Mary, and Joseph. Now bottoms up and double my dose.
Bottoms up, bottoms up. Hey, let's see you cup. Got a couple bottles.
Well, yeah.
Time will bring the veil and the body trial. There'll be no remnants, no trace, no retention. The feelings within you, then you won't remember, man.
I hear you, Jamal.
Okay, we are back. Okay, we are back here. CMT Firestorm. Let me see, check the connection right now. Chi-Town, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay, all right. Tex, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see. Let me see if Callie Mike. Callie Mike, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, good, good, good. So now we got the show ready to get started. I'm not exactly sure. Did you listen to Dr. Pepe's talk about the dark side of sports? Any thoughts about what he was talking about? Tex, let me ask, see what your opinion is.
I think there's always two sides to, you know, every story. I think it was kind of one-sided. I think there is some truth to what the doctor is saying. There's always, you know, there's always bad judgment amongst athletes that are involved. There was no mention about the responsibility and accountability of the other side that's involved, the girls or whatever else, or he did mention the coaches and the administrators letting it go on, but the people involved directly, like isn't a pro athlete, you know, involved with a woman or, you know, groupies or whatnot, it just comes across to me like it's 100% the athlete's fault. And again, they should conduct themselves in a certain way, but there's other people that are putting themselves into harm's way. The status deal goes both ways. It goes the athlete's way, and it goes a groupie's way or the crew's way or whoever else is trying to get involved with the athlete that has the status, as we would call it.
Okay. Callie, Mike, were you able to listen? And do you have any opinions on what Dr. Paper said?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a very interesting piece about, you know, what he said. I kind of agree with Tex, though. You know, it's a two-way street. You know, I think a lot of times we kind of put a stereotype on athletes as being almost kind of like these ogres, barbarian type of characters. You know, you see it in movies, you know, Revenge of the Nerds, you know, stuff like that. The athletes, you know, and they're always, you know, the big, you know, buff, you know, sex maniacs. And I think a lot of times maybe that seeps into our consciousness as almost a form of acceptability of, okay, that's what athletes are going to do. And, you know, like I said, I know myself, you know, being a high school athlete, knowing different college and professional athletes, I've seen, I mean, it's, first of all, okay, well, first of all, let me say, you know, it's a strong line between somebody being a sexual predator and somebody doing something that's sexually deviant. You know, to me, deviance really depends on, you know, whose standards are what you're looking at. A sexual predator is a totally different thing. That's when you get into Jerry Sandusky area. A guy who has, you know, relations with a lot of women, I wouldn't consider him a sexual predator. Now, I know that a lot of the cases that involve athletes are maybe brought to the forefront because of their status as an athlete and being, you know, a big man on campus, but that doesn't mean that most of these are athletes. I mean, you know, kind of like the author said, you know, like the doctor said at the end of his interview, it happens a lot in fraternities, groups, military, you know, any group where you have a group of people, especially when you have a lot of guys, testosterone starts flowing, things happen, you know, wild stuff happens, especially when, you know, you might introduce alcohol to it. But that's also not to say it doesn't happen with women either. You know, most of us who, you know, might have been in a girl's dorm have seen wild stuff happen, or whoever been a sorority party have seen wild stuff happen. And, you know, and I've heard what goes on at women's strip clubs is three times wilder what happens at men's strip clubs. You know, so I think, you know, like I said, there's two sides to it, you know, and I don't want to, you know, just put everything on athletes like they're all, you know, like they're big sex freaks or, you know, like I said, especially, you know, when you start getting, and, you know, calling, you know, people sexual predators and stuff like that. I think there's definitely sexual predators out there, but they're, you know, sexual, you know, for, you know, in my opinion, a sexual predator is someone who has something mentally wrong with them. And that, you know, is going to come out eventually, whether they're an athlete or not. You know, it doesn't, you know, and that's in all facets of society. You know, as we've seen with, you know, Jerry Sandusky, he's a coach and well-respected member of the community. He's a sexual predator. You know, you might have a policeman, you know, who's a sexual predator. Anybody could be a sexual predator, not just, you know, a linebacker at, you know, Middle Tennessee State or something like that.
Well, at the same time, though, don't you think with men in particular, I'm just going to put it out there. Women tend to try to gravitate towards athletes, particularly college athletes, high school athletes, the stars of the team. I mean, couldn't you evolve into something like that if you're used to getting in so easily?
Well, it's not natural. You know, it's not, you know, survival of the fittest. You know, and you know you can see that in animals. You know, the female lions are going to flock towards the dominant male. Any group of animals are going to flock towards whoever is dominant. He's going to become the alpha male. Athletes are often put in the alpha male role because of their athletic prowess and size. So, you know, if you're an alpha male, you're going to get that's like I said, that's just not in humans. That's in every facet of you know, any mammal out there, any animal out there. Dominant male is going to get the, you know, is going to have the women. That's, you know, where they're saying, you know, only the strong survive comes from.
All right. Shatan, I'm going to get your opinion on this before we get to a caller.
Fazil, I was trying to find the show. I was able not to. So, really, I got to hear more of it. So, but based on what
okay.
the guys are saying, I mean, I agree.
Okay, I think you're breaking up a little bit.
Culture. You know, it's just, you know, it's, I guess another
okay,
topic for that, but, you know, it's a sports show, but I kind of get what the guys are saying.
Okay, I'm going to get to a caller, and then we're going to get to our football topics. One caller here. Maybe not. I'm sorry. The caller hung up. So we can get started into our football topics here. This past weekend in college football, it was a very exciting week. Numbers 3, 4, and 5 fell to their opponents. And we're going to go over those games right now and figure out what happened with those games. And I picked two specific upsets. Oh, sorry about that. Let me take that back before we go to the next topic. Our caller did call back. We're going to talk about Dr. Papus. 813, excuse me, 813. Are you there?
Good afternoon. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I have some real issues with some of the things that the doctor said. I understand his point of view, but at the same time, I truly believe that it is a one-sided majority perception and opinion view where all they're looking for is a villain. All they're looking for is a villain, and the big bad male is always the villain over the poor innocent female. And I can understand that in 1919. I can understand that in 1980, but I don't understand that in 2012. Why? Because in the 21st century, women are intellectually capable of caring for themselves and avoiding the situations that they have heard about all their lives. And if they get themselves in that situation, and I'm not saying that it's always their fault, but they have the intellectual capacity and they have the know-how to keep themselves out of that situation. And I think a lot of the laws that we have on the books today are very gender biased. They have been promoted and put in place in an effect to make these athletes the villains. And, you know, the athletes aren't always the villains. If you aren't there, young lady, then you can't be raped. If you aren't there, you can't be assaulted. If you didn't get drunk, then you can't claim that you didn't know what was going on. There has to be some personal responsibility on the other side instead of just making all of these athletes out to be the big bad boogeyman.
Well, I'm with you there. I mean, I understand that maybe they shouldn't have been there in the first place, but let's just say something happens. You know, and this is a sports show. I don't want to get into no women's rights thing. But, you know, things happen. But if the woman says no, the woman just says no, right? I mean, that means okay, that gives the man no reason to do that. Don't get me wrong now. The woman shouldn't be there. But at the end of the day, what it boils down to is did the woman consent? That's what it boils down to. Did she consent or not? If she didn't consent, then the man should be held accountable. Wouldn't you think so?
Well, see,
I agree
with that part a little bit. I think that we're moving into a different area. We're talking about, you know, saying no is, you know, like I said, once again, we're veering into that's an area of rape, you know, as opposed to a guy who sleeps with a lot of women. You know, like I said,
okay, yeah, and the woman is consensually allowing it. Yeah, that's different. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm saying. That's why the doctor is kind of walking that line.
If you think of it from the perspective, if she didn't say no when you said hello, she didn't say no when you said, will you go home with me? She didn't say no when you said, take off your clothes. She didn't say no when you started having sex. And then halfway through, she decides to say no. When does she stop being responsible?
Well,
that's true.
I mean,
that's true.
That, I understand that. She's still responsible, but at the end of the day, that last step where you said, if she says no, that's the end of the situation. The power.
Okay, but if you're already in the middle of the sexual activity and she says no,
then you're supposed to stop.
When you pull out from that point, you're already guilty because you were doing it after she said no.
Right. So I mean,
she become responsible in this whole equation.
Well. I'm not saying she's responsible. Okay, I don't want to jump into no women's rights discussion about sex and what's not rape and whatnot. I'm just giving it for the female listeners. I'm pretty sure a lot of females would be offended. I wouldn't say offended, but they would raise their eyebrows over what you just said. So,
okay, well, I raise my eyebrows on them always.
I understand that. So I don't want to dwell into it too much. We want to stay on this pretty short because we want to get into our football coverage here. So I'm going to have to put you on hold real quick and let me just hear this one more opinion, and then we're going to go to the football coverage, okay?
No problem.
850.
All right. Let's just go on that little point real quick about what the previous caller said. Sure, there's like two sides to every story. I kind of understand what he's getting at because you have, you know, some of them cases where you have, you know, females just waiting on the opportunity to take advantage of the athlete. But you still, at the same time, got to have some type of control. And the thing about it is that a lot of these athletes that are pretty much coming out aren't really taught this and taught, like, as far as, like, who to go after, who's after you, and things like that, and who's being taken advantage of. I mean, I'm, you know, here watching right now, you know, that thing on ESPN at 30 for 30 broke, and you hear them stories about all those players losing money, the investments, and baby mamas, and all that. So, I mean, it's like you got to be careful as an athlete on, you know, the situation and what you're in.
True. That's true.
That's a good point. I agree with that. You know, it's funny, right, you know, they called the doctor come on because it did kind of tie itself into broke. One thing that I, you know, that I think, though, is I think that, like I say, with the athletes being high profile, it exasperates the position so much as, let's say, a regular guy has a one-night stand with a girl and the girl gets pregnant and she has a baby. This guy, you know, he's a regular guy. He doesn't live in the city where she had the baby at. She might not ever see him again and get stuck with a baby. She might not decide to have that baby. But if she, Deion Sanders gets her pregnant, no matter where in the country he goes, she's going to be able to find him and get her child support. And 9 times out of 10, she's going to have that baby and get paid off of it, no matter if he wants the kid or not.
I mean, that's just
the athlete. You know, it gets, you know, the high profile athlete, high profile the person is gonna, you know, is gonna exasperate any situation.
Hmm. Well, I mean, that's just how it is, man. I mean, there's no really other way to legislate that. There's no other way to go around that. It's just how it is. Unfortunately, it's nothing else I can really say. All right. Well, Let me put you on hold, James.
All right.
And figure out what's the issue with the sound here.
Somebody's listening to the show and it's making feedback from the close to the speakers.
Okay. So now let's start with the show here. Let's go over this past weekend with the college football here. There's a lot of upsets. Numbers 3, 4, and 5 were all upset. LSU lost, Florida State lost, and Georgia lost. And I had predicted, let me just say this before we get into the argument, I had predicted that LSU would lose to Florida in the Swamp, and I had predicted that South Carolina would beat Georgia, and I'm pretty sure most of the people on this panel thought I was crazy, as they always do. Most of the people on my Facebook wall thought I was crazy, as they always do, but unfortunately I was right. But let's just go. It's not a matter of fact of me being right.
You left out one part of that equation. What about the Florida State game? Those other two games were up in the air because those were two highly ranked teams versus highly ranked teams. Well, who did you pick? Who did you pick in the Florida State game?
I probably took Florida State, and I didn't even pick that game. We didn't even discuss that game because we assumed that Florida State would win anyway. We were all wrong. I mean, I'm pretty sure everybody on this panel thought Florida State was going to win that game.
At one point in the season, you had Florida State playing in the national championship, didn't you?
Yes. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I had Arkansas and Oklahoma. And obviously I'm wrong with that. And another thing I'll say I was wrong with was I was dead wrong. We're going to get into the discussion in a minute. Another thing I said I was wrong about is based on what I saw with Alabama 2 weeks ago, I said Alabama was the closest thing to the 2001 Miami Hurricanes. But with the way Alabama played offensively, not defensively, but offensively, Tex, 2 weeks ago, I didn't see them in the same league as that 2001 Miami Hurricane. So I will have to say that I was wrong about that. But let's just go down the games here. The LSU-Florida game, I'm assuming most of us watched that game. What do you think would happen to LSU? I mean, how did they end up with that L? I'm going to start with you, Tex.
Well, to start off with the I want to say first that Florida and LSU's defense, both of them have pretty good defenses. The quarterback play was mediocre on both sides of the ball. I think it just came down to Odell Beckham's turnover, which was huge. I'm not sure what the guy was thinking, but, I mean, that was big. Florida in the second half, they were very, very physical. The safety, Mark Elam, I mean, he was, goodness, he was, you know, he was hitting everything moving, even teammates move, hit him. So I think Florida just kind of hunkered down and they just, you know, they decided, okay, this is an SEC game. It's going to be filthy. Let's just run straight forward. Let's smash them in the mouth and see what happens. See if LSU will stay with us. And it didn't help that LSU lost a couple of starters too, but, I mean, they're still talented, though they did lose two starters, but – Florida was very, very physical. You know, my sleeper team, ascending team still, getting better each week. I mean, now your confidence is sky high when you beat LSU. So now, you know, just everybody else come beat us.
Well, I mean, do you think I want to ask Callie Mike, I guess, in Chi-Town. I mean, do you think Florida is going to go run the table now? I mean, is it – Is that a possibility? And if they would lose, who do you think they're going to lose to? Callie Mike or Shot?
Are you talking to Mike?
I mean, I'm talking to all of you guys, basically.
I don't know if they have an identity offensively that's good enough to carry them all the way through in the SEC as past champions. I don't know. I mean, they are physical. They run a little bit. I mean, they are a running offense, but I mean, you don't think of them like you think of Oregon. You know what I'm saying? Or Florida State or West Virginia. So I don't know if they can do it with playing offense the way they are now. I would like to see them pick one way and go that way. Although this Driscoll is getting a little better, but I think they can make that money on the ground. I just don't know if the offense is complete enough to run all the way through, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that they can't run the table. It's possible, but I mean it's the SEC. You know, week in and week out. This is just the beginning of the grind. So
interesting that you said. I want you to say something, Shatown Mike, and then Callie Mike. I got something to follow up with you after the caller when you said no offensive identity text. I just really – that was something interesting you said. But go Shatown. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm looking at the schedule of Florida. I see Vandy, but we already know Florida should take care of business than that. I see they got South Carolina and Georgia. You know, that's two battles. You know that's a cocktail party, that Georgia game. And after that, really, then Florida State. So, really, we'll see, you know, what they do against South Carolina. I know I saw on your Facebook status over the weekend, they said, mark my word, South Carolina, you know, has something for Florida. They think South Carolina's going to get them. So, I mean, that was a big win.
That.
So, it's possible that South Carolina can get them boys. So, we'll see.
You got any comments on this, Callie Mike?
Yeah, I look at it like, you know, you got basically four teams, Georgia, South Carolina, LSU, and Florida, who are very similar. You know, Georgia this weekend ended up being the oddball out, by not stepping up. But like I said, that Florida LSU game, you know, that game is not, you know, nobody, you know, I didn't see any, you know, he's in dominant, you know, like I said, a couple of, you know, Elam and a couple other guys, you know, they really you know, really played good. But, you know, like I said, it could have went either way. The one thing I know about LSU, and like I said at the beginning of the season when we found out Matthew wasn't playing, and, you know, I told Tex about it, they don't have a game breaker in me. I think that in order for them to be successful, maybe Odell Beckham, or I really think Russell Shepard, who hasn't been very quiet this year, has to step up and become that game buster for them. They don't have that spark anymore. With this kind of offense, you definitely need that kind of guy to come in there and provide a spark, who can break off, you know, a 20 or 30 yard end around, or catch a 60 yard bomb and just, you know, get things set off. You can't, you know, it's good to have a excellent running game, but you know, when you face an excellent defense, you know, especially, you know, away. You know, in a way, you need something to take the hot air out the crowd. You know, when you're
okay.
In a place
like, I want to hear what a caller has to. I'm sorry, I want to hear what a caller has to say. He's been holding on for a while. 813.
It's great to be a Florida Gator. Said it's great to be.
Oh my God.
Florida Gator. Did not look. 4 weeks ago, about a month ago, we was having this conversation, and I remember everybody on this show was saying how my Gators wasn't going to do it. They said they wasn't even going to beat LSU. Now, here's some crow for every one of y'all. Y'all hungry? Y'all need to eat.
Well, I predicted that UF would win. I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, you want to know what makes Florida the team to beat? Fourth quarter conditioning. That is why they are as good as they are. They start weak, but they finish strong every single week. If you look at that game against Texas A&M, you look at that game last week, they start slow, but they finish strong. And that is what makes the SEC elite over all the other leagues, and what makes Florida
Those are
SEC teams they play.
Do what? They played LSU. They beat LSU. You got to give them that now, Mike.
They played Tennessee. They beat Tennessee. Tennessee ain't no drop in the bucket.
That's another SEC team. Let's see how that makes
sense. What I'm saying is, with that fourth quarter conditioning, they have literally gone out and shown themselves to be the team to beat in the fourth quarter. And that's why Florida State lost. They ain't ready for the fourth quarter. It ain't how you start a game, it's how you finish a game. Fourth quarter conditioning is why Florida Gators 5-0.
All right, I'm gonna put you on hold real quick, and I'm gonna hear what 850 has to say here. 850 CMT Firestorm.
Well, since we're talking about the LSU Florida game, first off, I'm going off a disclaimer that I didn't see like most of that game. Only saw pretty much the end of the third and the fourth quarter. And I think one of the panelists said that key turnover was the turning point of the game, because that turnover that the receiver had was pretty much LSU's drive after Florida scored that first touchdown. So once they had that fumble, that pretty much gave Florida the football back. And I think that next drive, they pretty much ran the ball up the field with like 14 or 15 straight running plays and then got that touchdown. They go up 14-6. Now they're going with the previous caller said. He said that the Gators pretty much finished in the fourth quarter. Actually, it hurts me to say this, but it's actually more than that. It's actually the second half, because I'm not sure on this, but I don't think that the Gators have allowed either a touchdown or even a point in the second half this season. So it's not just finishing strong in the fourth quarter, but it's finishing strong in the second half.
Well, since you said that, now, do you think they're going to run the – I mean, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked the rest of the panel. Do you think they could win the rest of their games?
No.
Who's next in line? South Carolina?
We both agree that South Carolina would beat Florida in the swamp.
Yeah, we did do that. Yeah, we did.
So, I mean, and it's not like South Carolina hasn't done before. They did it 2 years ago. So that's the one thing, and it's that not only do they have that, but they still have to play Georgia in Jacksonville. You know, I'm not sure if Georgia will pull off that game. They still have to play Florida State in Tallahassee. And depending on what happens within the rest of the season, they could still have that SEC championship game, which most likely they'll face Alabama. And I don't think they could beat Alabama either.
Okay. All right. Any final comments? I'm going to put you on hold, James. Any final comments from the panel in regards to LSU Florida? Because we got to move on. We got some more topics to talk about.
I guess not. A big win for Florida.
Well, I guess the next question is, before we get into the other game with South Carolina and Georgia, there's something on my mind I want to talk about. Oregon, they had a really impressive win against Washington this past week, and they scored 50 points, and they've been pretty good. They've been very impressive this year, Oregon. I guess my question is, since Alabama is number one in the nation, who do you think is the team? Do you think they're going to make it through the season undefeated? And if you don't think they're going to do that, who do you think is the team that's going to beat them? And if they get to the national championship, could a team like Oregon beat them? Will a team like Oregon beat them? Let's just put it that way. So I guess I'm going to start with you, Tex.
To me, whoever comes out the SEC is going to win the national championship. I don't care who it is.
Let's say Georgia
flips the switch and becomes really good, wins the rest of their games, wins the SEC championship game. You think they can play against Oregon and beat them?
Well, I'm not really talking about Georgia at this point being a contender for a national title. I'm talking about Bama. I still think, I know we're down on LSU. I still like LSU. I still like the defensive talent, but they're just numerically, they're probably done. You know, it's too far to climb back in there. I think we're talking about Bama, Florida, and South Carolina. I just think it's a different – I mean, just whoever was to play one of these – whoever makes it from the SEC in the BCS title game, I just think it's a different brand of football. You know, maybe if a Southeastern Conference squad played in the Pac-10 or played in another conference, maybe – it wouldn't matter so much, but I just think the brand of football is, while not advanced or innovative or creative like the Pac-12 or the Big 12 or whatever, while it's not as advanced, I just think it's a smash mouth, grind it out. You know, we're gonna out tough you, we're gonna outlast you, we're gonna fire off the line and stop us. These O lines and these D lines in the SEC are just too deep, and I mean trench play is where it's at. So I don't see any other team in a BCS title game beating the Southeast Conference squad. Not, you know, they'd have to dumb it down and they have to play that game. I mean, we saw this between Auburn and Oregon. We kind of saw it last year with LSU, Oregon. Oregon, great team. But I don't think that these other teams have the physicality of an SEC squad. Physicality plus athleticism.
Okay, let me see what you have to say, Shottown Mike, before I get to you, Gally Mike. I know you have some opinion on that. What's your opinion, Shottown?
I was going to say, too, about Oregon, though. They were saying this Oregon defense here is better than the defense they have when they went to the championship against Cam Newton, so... we'll just see on that, though. But, you know, I mean, they doing their thing. I mean, they play their game, and let's say their defense takes it up to a level and their offense just be able to score, then they might have a chance. That Auburn and Oregon game, I mean, it was a pretty competitive game, though, most of the game. And then Auburn got it going, you know. But right now, I mean, it you know, they had the edge, the SEC, you know. whoever comes out of it has a, you know, favorable chance and probably will be the favorites. But, you know, if a team that could give them a push, you know, I mean, we've seen what they did. That Oregon team, you know, it's just seeing what they can do. So right now I won't say anything, but if they get in there, it could be another competitive BCS championship game.
What's your opinion on that, Cali Mike?
I look at it like this, and I've been thinking about it over the weekend, and I'm gonna try to be as completely as unbiased as I can.
Yeah, right.
So I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot this weekend, and I look at, like I say, can always hear a lot of talk about the SEC defenses, and you know, and how good they are, and that's the reason why the games are like that. Well, if that's the reason why the games are like that in the SEC, why aren't the games like that in the NFL? And we can all agree that the NFL is the top talent out of all of college football. Why aren't there 7-6 games in the NFL and such games like there are in the SEC? Why is the NFL league just dominated by quarterbacks and like, you know, like other leagues like the Pac-10 and the Big Ten produce? Why is that? Why does everything change when it's to the NFL?
Only the best of the best get the burn in the league. As to where in college,
but the SEC is the best of the best, though, right? I'm just talking about the top SEC teams. That's the best of the best, right?
In terms of defense, yes.
But it's more the defense.
No, we're talking about period. All of college football. That's the best of the best, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think they're the best of the best in terms of defense. I don't think they're necessarily the best of the best in terms of quarterback play.
I'm not just talking about us. But the consensus is that the SEC is the best of the best of college football. Why doesn't that transfer over?
They have the best.
You know what I'm saying? Why don't we see games like that in the NFL?
Well, you have
you just brought up Oregon Auburn, you know, the Oregon Auburn game. Auburn didn't dominate Oregon. That was a 3-point game.
Yeah, it was.
And that was Deron Thomas threw for almost 400 yards on that defense. Right? And that was Deron Thomas.
But in the flow of the game, he wasn't making plays like he was against everybody else. During the season,
threw for 400 yards against the best defense. I mean, come on.
Auburn wasn't the best defense that year.
Huh?
Auburn didn't have the best college defense that year.
Uh-oh.
They just had
they
Nick
won
Fairley.
The SEC, right? They won the SEC, right? They were the best.
They had
the
best.
Right?
They had the best player. Okay, but the point I'm making is, okay, Cali Mike. I will say this. It's not a clear cut SEC all the way, in my opinion, this year. That's just my opinion. Now, I understand maybe Tex believes that, and I'm pretty sure Shottown Mike does not believe that. But I think the best team, or maybe the top two teams, maybe the best team is out the SEC. That's what I believe. But if you're talking about in terms of defensive line.
I like Alabama. I believe that too. But like I said, I mean, LSU, last year, they went out and played Oregon, and they beat Oregon. I can't say
anything about
that. I can't say, like I said, when an SEC team goes out of conference and beats another team, I can't say nothing about that. But how often does that happen?
It happens often.
Until the bowl season, which I can't, like I say, until the bowl season, how often do we see a game like Auburn, going to USC or Georgia, coming to Ohio State or something like that, or such and such going to Texas? You very rarely see that. The other conferences, you see it
all
the time.
That's not true. That is not true.
Let's name them. Let's not just say it ain't true. Let's name them.
Now USC goes else. It's very – well, Texas doesn't do that. Texas too scared to do that. OU,
Texas
at least they'll
going
go
to Ohio State when Ohio State was still good.
Oh, that's – I mean, are we talking about recent –
Alabama travels. Georgia travels.
Been?
LSU travels. Alabama went to Penn State. Alabama went to Penn State. Alabama played Michigan.
They went to who?
They weren't good, but they left it. Hold up. That wasn't the first time they did it. Alabama went to Oklahoma one year. Alabama will do that. Now, there's schools in the SEC that won't do that, like Florida. Florida generally won't do that. They won't go over out onto the other side of the country to play another team. But there are teams in the SEC that will do that.
I'm saying who?
We can. We can.
I just named you a few. I named you. Alabama does it. LSU will do it.
Alabama. When does Alabama? Okay, Alabama went to Penn State. Penn State stinks. Okay, they went to.
Yeah, they went to Oklahoma. LSU went to Washington last year.
When did Alabama go to Oklahoma?
They went to Oklahoma like about 4 or 5 years ago. They did a home and home. They did a home and home against Oklahoma. They did. Oh, I got somebody to. Real quick. I got a caller here who's really knowledgeable at this. Well, I got to get to this first caller first. I'm going to get to you, the 850 in a second. Let me get 813 first.
Wait a minute, Cali Mike. First and foremost, the reason why the SEC don't travel is because we the best. If you want
here
us,
we go.
You come
here
to
we
us.
Go.
We don't
here
come
we go.
To you.
Here we go. Here we go.
We don't come to you. Secondly,
this is a typical
no,
SEC.
Secondly,
answer.
You
were
saying how we get beat in the bones. I think you got us sadly mistaken. The
I never
SEC
said that.
Wins the majority of every
I never,
bowl
I never
every
said that.
Year.
Going.
Every single year, we win the majority of the bowls that we are in. And finally, Oregon State sucks. I mean, Oregon sucks. Just because they play in that cupcake league where they don't have to play nobody and they play teams like Washington who ain't been nothing for the last 20 years, all of a sudden you want to talk about how good they are? They ain't no good because they play cupcakes. They suck. Every time they get in the game to where it counts against an SEC team, they get blasted every time.
They do.
And they get blasted.
All right. Put you on hold, yo. I'm gonna put you on hold. Tony. I'm gonna put you on hold. All right. I gotta get this other caller in.
My name was made up too.
All right. And who's your 850?
All right. Hello. You got me?
Yeah, I got you.
All right. Now we're going on this point about the SEC and how they travel and everything like that. And I'm completely agreeing with Clausell. The reason being is, Fazell mentioned some games when Alabama travel and LSU travel. Tennessee has had a home and home against UCLA. Georgia's went out against Oklahoma State, Arizona State, and so forth. So it's not like these top teams like LSU, Georgia, South Carolina, and the like don't go out and travel. They do. You just don't. You know, hear about it as much because everybody is hyping up the SEC conference in conference that they totally ignore that these other teams do travel. He did bring up that point about Florida not traveling, though, because here's the thing about Florida. They always go with that. Either they play Florida State or Miami. It's not a conference game. You can't go by that. Because you see Georgia and South Carolina playing the likes of Georgia Tech and Clemson, and they still travel, but Florida doesn't. That's why Clausell brought up Florida as an exception. But
okay, I understand that. But look at the game today, though. Okay, Georgia, when they went to Oklahoma State, what happened? They lost. Tennessee, when they went to UCLA, what happened? They lost.
So
well,
I mean, what's going to have to happen is. Well, I think what you want is, let's say, Alabama or LSU, they go and play Oregon for a home and home.
Right.
You know?
I would like
that's
to see.
They can't play. Alabama can't play UCLA for a home and home, which they have done before, Mike. I don't know if you remember that. They have played a home and home against UCLA. It has to be like an Alabama versus a USC.
This is what I don't want to see. I don't want to see us talking about Florida going to a national championship when – three of Florida's last games, well, Vanderbilt is a season game, conference game, but two of Florida's last games are against Louisiana Lafayette and Jacksonville State. I don't want to hear them talking about national championship playing those teams at the end of the season.
Yeah, those are preps for Florida State.
Hold on, though. But the thing about it is that teams like that in the SEC are pretty much getting forgiven for that. Yeah, that last part of the schedule is not that good. But the way that the system is now, you really aren't getting penalized for having a week to change the schedule no matter where it is. So they could play those teams, I mean, you know, later in the season, but they'll still have that number two and number three ranking in the BCS, especially come next week because either Florida or Notre Dame might be number two once those things come out. But since you don't have to, you know, play those LSUs or go to USC and so forth, like you see Ohio State, they go to Texas, USC and so forth and the like. But you don't see the SEC team join, like, the upper echelon programs because they don't have
to. And that's my point. I don't.
Well, I mean, the other schools don't have to play the SECs. It's a two-way street, you know. They're going to have to be willing to play the SEC on a home-and-home, too. Oregon's going to have to be willing to.
USC came and played Auburn when they was good and blew them out, and they played Arkansas.
They played Arkansas in a home-and-home. Yeah,
but then Arkansas wasn't that good then. Arkansas was not Arkansas then.
Yeah, but Auburn was pretty good.
That was Arkansas
then.
When they had Darren McFadden.
Yeah, they did.
And
they
Auburn,
did. That's true.
Auburn was ranked, too.
That was the same Auburn team who went to, everybody said should have went to the national championship the next year. SC blew them out.
Yep, that was true the next year. Well, they didn't blow them out. I saw that game. They didn't blow them out. They just won the game. But the point I'm making is.
They blew them out.
Hey, you know what? It's a good conversation, you know. I mean,
but it's not even conversation. Look at it. They're playing Jacksonville State is their next last game before they play Jacksonville State.
I mean, they're preparing. They're preparing for the for Florida State.
No,
Louisiana Lafayette.
I mean, here's the point. It's like, can you name one team that Florida has played on the road that's like a real tough game that is outside the state of Florida?
Yeah, Texas A&M, that's the closest one. All right.
And that was
a
conference game.
Exactly. So, I don't know. Hold on. Let me let 21.
They play Florida. Florida played four road games and eight home games this year.
All right, hold on real quick. I'm going to put you on hold, James, and we're going to have to put my mother, have to let Tony Watley respond. 813.
The reason that you all seem to miss out there, Tally Mike, is the fact that until the last couple of years, you didn't even have a conference championship in the Pac-12. None of them sorry-ass cupcake teams out there
that
even play a championship game.
All right.
We got to worry about playing a big game at the end of the year after we don't play the whole season. Y'all didn't have to worry about nothing out there in California but sitting on your butts.
Is that it?
I had to let him rebut
here. Okay, I'm gonna put you on hold now. I'll put you on hold. All right, I'll put you on hold, Tony Wiley.
All right.
Let's change the subject here.
Please.
What I want to know is
let's briefly talk about
Georgia, South Carolina, real quick. I want to get into some NFL talk too. Which out of these three games, the Florida State game, the LSU game, the Georgia-South Carolina game, what game shocked you the most? I don't think LSU versus Florida shocked you the most. What game really just shocked you the most in terms of, like, wow, they got beat pretty bad, or wow, they got beat this weekend? It could be any game.
It had to be Georgia-South Carolina for sure. I mean, like I said, I picked Georgia to win that one, you know. I don't know what's going on in Georgia. South Carolina, they played a good game. That boy Clowney, man, he's gonna do some things when he gets in the league. I think he's on sophomore too, and he's a beast.
They whole front seven is, man, just think if they still have Mel Ingram and Stephen Gilmore.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, are they LSU front seven techs?
I'd say right now they might be just to a man, to a starter.
But LSU got the
You heard me say that in recent weeks that South Carolina. You heard me talk about their front seven.
Yeah, you have. But I mean, I know you are big on LSU's defense. I mean, you like salivate over LSU's defense. Do you think LSU's defense is better than Alabama's?
I don't salivate over their defense, but yeah, I'll still take LSU's defense over Bama. I'll take LSU's as a defense, as a
Entire defense, yeah. But if I have to pick a front seven, it's going to be SC's front seven.
Okay,
I mean,
got you.
Tremendous front seven, man.
Okay. Well, the game that shocked me, I think, was definitely was the LSU South Carolina. But part of me, the Florida State game shocked me too. I was watching the game. I watched the entire second half, and I was just shocked. I think they were just playing not to lose. They weren't playing to like kill the. They weren't playing to assassinate them. They were just playing not to lose, and I think that caught up with them at the end of the day. Maybe it was the play calling. I really thought I would expect more out of EJ Manuel to be more of a big time player. That may have dropped his draft status a little bit, but I was just really surprised, particularly from the offense, because the offense is what cost him that game. I think the defense came to play. They did all they could, but that just shocked me with the FSU-North Carolina State game. Do you think FSU could bounce back from this? They have Miami coming up. They have Florida coming up at home. Do you think they can bounce back from this? Shottown, what do you think?
I was going to say this before you say Miami. I'm kind of disappointed in Miami. I thought Miami would have put up a little bit more than, you know.
Yeah, the Miami looked very disappointed. I thought they were going to come in there and do something too.
Yeah, but coming back to that Florida State game, Miami game, you know, that's going to be interesting. You know, like you said, we know it's a rivalry. I know Miami getting whooped. Definitely going to put on.
All right, you break it up.
It wouldn't surprise me if Miami beat them.
Well, nah. Come on now.
throw out the records, throw out everything else. So Ryan, to think about it, how they got embarrassed like that, you know, 41-3. Or put
man,
it like this. They're going to play better, though.
They are not beating Florida State.
Yeah, the game's in Miami now, Tex. The game's in Miami. Florida State's not in a good psychologically right now. So, but at the same time, though, when Miami probably is not good.
Have you all watched Miami play?
Yeah, I saw them play. Yeah, I saw them play against Notre Dame. It didn't look pretty.
This team is not. They're not. You know, they're not beating Florida State. They're not beating Florida. And I'm a UM. No.
Well, I want to slightly change the subject here, real quick. Notre Dame, you know, they're in the mix now. I think USC, they have to go to USC and play them, but they're undefeated. They have a very good defense. According to the NCAA rankings, they're a top 15 defense. So, I mean, but wasn't that impressive what you saw against Miami, though? You got to be impressed with that now.
You drove a bunch of freshmen and sophomores. Fine. but you drove them. But let me tell you something, man. I like that Notre Dame quarterback. I like that quarterback. He's a baller. He's not scared. And I texted Mike during the game. I was looking at the running back, and I was like, man, how Notre Dame get him? He don't even look like that kind of athlete. You know, turned out he was a USC commit before all the sanctions went down. But the quarterback and the running back, I think their linebacker is pretty good. He's still a liability in coverage, although if you talk to a Big Ten pundit, they'll say, oh, he picked off Denard Robinson three times. Yes, Denard Robinson. But I think they do have a leader on defense. Their quarterback is good. The quarterback will probably give him a chance 97-96% of the time on Saturdays or whenever they play. The running back is a pretty good athlete. So, you know, I'm not pretending that there's nothing there at Notre Dame. There's something there, but, you know, there's playing somebody like USC at South Bend, and then there's going to SoCal and playing. You understand? We can't get carried around with them because when you keep playing Big Ten teams, you're gonna be what? Top 15 defense in the nation? Yeah, you're gonna be top defense in the nation.
You're going hard on the Big Ten, boy. Hey, let me get Cali Mike real quick. Let me get your opinion on this. Like, do you think Notre Dame could Do you think they can run the table to USC?
Well, they, like I said, they could, you know. And also, you know, like I told you, you know, SC is not out of the, you know, they're not out of the picture yet. Any top 10 team right now, I think, has a chance because there's still a lot of football to be played. Like I said, SC still has games against. They still got no, they don't play Oregon State this year. They still got Notre Dame. They still got Oregon. And then they got wherever else they can play in the, you know, in the Pac-10, in the Pac-12 championship. Notre Dame, they got a good team. I mean, you can only get so many, you know, good recruits, and you know, until you accidentally fall into a team. You know, it's like it'd be hard for them to make a bad team, really. You know, like I say, especially with their schedule, they got good recruits. They, you know, they've had to let guys go that I thought of, you know, good. You know, they had to let a couple of guys go off the team that I thought were good. But, you know, they've been having, you know, constant top recruiting classes. So, I mean, it's, you know, eventually you figure they put it all together and, keep guys healthy, keep them on the field. I mean, that was, you know, like I said, that was a good game they played against Miami. You know, I can't take nothing away. Miami is a very young team. But, you know, Notre Dame went there and they put those points on the board. It's going to be very interesting. But they got a tough rest of the season left. So, it's, you know, it's too early for me to, you know, to really, I can't really say, you know, they still got Oklahoma. They play in Stanford this weekend. They're going to, you know, and like I say, I mean, at the end of the year, they play SC. So, you know, it's a lot of football to be played. But, you know, like I say, to me, everything is really wide open right now. It's a lot, you know, like I say, because, you know, the SEC teams, those teams, like I say, they're starting to come into their NCC run. A lot of them are going to get knocked off. You're going to see a lot of people in the top 10 right now. They're not going to be in the top 10 anymore. You know, but, and also you're going to see a lot of teams, like I say, you know, you guys said it last week, I thought they would lose, but keep eye on West Virginia. You know, they won, so this was pretty much one of their only hurdles, you know, of the year. So who knows what they might do the rest of the year.
True,
yeah.
True.
You can very well
I did pick West Virginia in that one, too.
Yeah, I think all y'all did except for me. I think I was the only one picking to lose.
All right.
You sure did pick Texas.
Nah, I picked W. I ain't, there's no way I'm ever taking the Longhorns in a big game.
All right, let me get this caller in. Let me get this caller in, 850.
All right, you got me?
Yeah, I got you.
All right. Well, first off, I guess I'm going to go backwards, I guess. The instance with Notre Dame is that, well, sure they don't look all too impressive to a lot of people, but we're talking about Notre Dame here. And the last three games, they haven't, you know, allowed a touchdown, which pretty much impressed the, you know, the media and the posters. And like I said in the earlier segment, they might be one of the top three teams in the BCS come next week. Don't be surprised if that happens. They're already up in the top of those other computer-type polls or whatever.
Yeah, I think they said they were number one in the computer rankings I was reading somewhere.
In two polls.
God. They are.
Yeah,
oh,
they're number one in the rankings, right? And Florida's right behind them, and
yep,
they're pretty high on a couple of other ones. So yeah, so don't be surprised if you see them around number two or number three in the BCS standings. Now, that being said, I'm not really impressed with their offense. It's that their defense has pretty much been really good, with the exception of that Michigan game when, you know, Michigan gave them like 20 turnovers and they only scored 13 points on them. So that's the thing about Notre Dame. Now, about the game that really shocked me the most last week, I would go with that South Carolina-Georgia game because South Carolina impressed me, but I would go with the Florida State game. And the reason why is not because of their offense, but because of the defense at the end of the game. They were, that last drive, they let go of three straight fourth down conversions to NC State. And a lot of the big plays that they had in third down and fourth down, when I'm talking about NC State, was is that the quarterback was able to, like, throw the ball down the middle to the tight end or to the slot receiver. There was, like, no safeties, no middle linebackers in the middle of the field. And they got first down after first down after first down. You would think that with the defense that Florida State is supposed to have, they would make the adjustment to try to get that, you know, stop. And when NC State scored that last touchdown, third down and fourth down, they pretty much did the same play across the middle when they screened out that outside linebacker that was guarding them. So they did two straight plays on Florida State, and Florida State still couldn't stop.
I mean, any thoughts on that?
I was surprised that SC and Georgia. I didn't think it was going to be a blowout like that. I mean, it's number six versus number five. I mean, you know, were you really expecting a blowout? No, so that was surprising. But just Florida State to go out there and just lay that egg against NC State. You know, you're supposed to have to turn around, you know, getting back on at least one of the two of the Florida schools, getting back on the map, and then you go and you lose to NC State with the talent you
all
have.
Well,
it's disappointing.
Another thing about that NC State Florida State thing is crazy because areas like the last few times that Florida State has been ranked and they play NC State, NC State has beat them. So it's like, okay, you know what the deal is, but you still get beat. So that would be crazy in itself. And another thing was that NC State thing allowed 44 points to Miami the week before, and like, what was it, 440 some passing yards to Stephen Morris? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, I gotta get this next caller in. Not to interrupt. Hold on, let me get to this next caller in. 813, real quick. 813.
You got to be kidding me, gentlemen.
Oh my.
You got to be kidding me. Don't call Notre Dame Notre Dame. Call Notre Dame make believe. Because they ain't about nothing. They ain't nothing. All they are the media darlings. That's why they're the team that gets to be on television every single week. They want them to be the greatest team, but they ain't about nothing because they ain't played nobody. And just because they can get pick and choose who they get to play, they play one or two good teams a year while they play all of these military academies and stuff, all of a sudden you want to call them a good team? They're fakes. There's nothing about them that's real, and you know this whole BCS and ranking system is set up to make sure that you get a Notre Dame, a Big Ten, a Big 12 conference to play the SEC in the national championship. It's all a hoax, and Notre Dame is a fake.
You know, it's funny because a couple of years ago, people were saying about an SEC team with a quarterback. Who was it? They were really overrated, and the quarterback's overrated now. He's in the league. Oh, yeah, Tim Tebow, and he went to
saying to you is the SEC has won the last six national championships. That ain't overrated, my friend. When was the last time Notre Dame
Can you name one player from U.S. championship team that's doing anything in the league right now?
All right, hold on.
We're talking about college football. We ain't talking about the NFL.
Come to think about it, didn't Will Hill just get arrested for drugs or something like that?
We ain't talking about the NFL. We're talking about college football. And in college football, the SEC is real and Notre Dame is fake.
Oh, that's what I want to say, Clark. That's what I also want to say. If the SEC is this good, how did Tim Tebow become one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time?
It was about his defense, and he had two of the best wide receivers in the NFL today.
He threw for 3,000 yards like every season played there. He ran for 20 touchdowns. How could he do that over the top defenses in college football? It has to be that.
He's the best because he had a great defense, he had a great offensive line, and he had two great receivers that could go up and catch any of those sorry-ass ducks he threw.
Who are those receivers? Where do they play in the league right now?
Aaron Hernandez, Percy Harvin. They're not good?
Thank you.
Percy Harvin was playing mostly running back when he was at UF. Come on now.
Aaron Hernandez and Percy Harvin were integral parts of those teams.
Tim Tebow was running over cats. Tebow was
going for only four
in the season.
All right, we got to move on here, and we're going to get into Tim Tebow actually right now. We got to move on here. Let me put you on hold here real quick. All right, Tony Wiley. Yeah, let's get into Tim Tebow right now. We're going to go into NFL for a little bit. We got about 20 minutes left. Mark Sanchez is not looking good at the quarterback position for the New York Jets. The Jets are, I think there's still one game out in first place. Here. think it's time to bring in Tebow? let me start with Shottown first with this one. Let me start with – I kind of got an idea what Texas is going to say, but let me start with Shottown first, right?
I say no because, I mean, being real, I thought the Jets was going to get blown out by the Texans. Then turn out, you know, they made it a game. You know what I mean? On Monday night, 23-17, and they almost had a chance to win the game. You know, Sanchez threw that interception right there, but then, you know, everybody wants to blame, you know, put everything on Sanchez. I mean, yeah, he's not been playing well. I mean, of course, it's New York, so you know how it is, the media out there and stuff, but the Jets is just not a good team. They're not playing good football right now. So, really, I mean, you know, I think Mark Sanchez can give them a better chance to win than Tim Tebow, but let's say they do go with that change. It's not going to change nothing. Like I say again, the Jets is not a good football team right now, you know. Antonio Holmes is out for the year, and, you know, Revis on defense, of course, they superstar playmaker on defense. He's out, so, I mean, that's the
Well, Callie, Mike, what you have to say about that? Should they bring in Tim Tebow?
The quarterback position is the marquee position, so win or lose, that's going to be under scrutiny. All I can say is this. The Jets are not doing that good as a team. Even with the interception Sanchez threw, that was off of deflection. It wasn't a straight interception. When you bring in Antonio Cromartie as a wide receiver, the team is not doing so high. And I forget who was on that game. Anyway, I'm going to see him play in high school, and I don't remember him playing wide receiver. But they had Quazo Thorpe as a wide receiver. I don't remember seeing Cromartie out there dominating on anybody. So, I mean, what's he saying about it? You want to bring in Tim Tebow? Yes, I want him to bring in Tim Tebow so this can stop. Because I know it's going to happen when he comes in. It's going to be all right.
I mean, you don't think. All right, Tex, I want to get you.
Let me say this right now. Tim Tebow is the worst first-round quarterback I've ever seen.
In terms of passing the ball, that's right.
What the Broncos taking Tim Tebow first round? I remember that, Mike.
I challenge anybody to name a first round quarterback worse than Tim Tebow.
I can't right now, but this is the point. Tex, and I'm gonna let you go last because I know you have something to say about this. But these are the three things. These are my rules of the three things you have to do to be an NFL quarterback. Are you accurate? That's number one. Number two, can you make all the NFL throws? And number three, when the game's on the line, can you deliver? So with Tim Tebow, the issue is he accurate? Absolutely not. Can he make all the throws? Not really.
But
number three, when the game's on the line, can you deliver? He can do that now. We got to admit to that. He can do that now. Can he? He can't do that? Are you kidding me? Come on, man. When the game's on the line, Tebow can deliver. But the thing with Mark Sanchez,
quarterbacks. Matt Castle.
Matt Castle. When the game was on the line, he can't deliver, huh?
But also, you forgot. Mark Sanchez did lead the Jets to two AFC championships, though. You can't forget about that.
Exactly. Well, yeah, you got to put that in there. Yeah, he's not a bust. Mark Sanchez is not a bust. But the issue with Mark Sanchez is he accurate? Sometimes he's not that accurate. And this season,
all time.
No, because the thing that keeps him relevant is the fact that when the game's on the line, Tim Tebow can deliver. And right now, Mark Sanchez,
he made one pass over blown coverage against Pittsburgh. Let's stop saying
that. You're right. But he did it against Miami. He did it against the Chicago Bears. I understand that, Marion Barber fumble. I understand that. I know.
Who's playing quarterback for Chicago and Miami? Who's leading? Caleb Haney? Might not even been him. Who was the Miami quarterback? Of course, there was some resistance. Who was putting up resistance? From Miami
last year's game? That was Matt Moore, I believe. You're talking about last year, right? That's Matt Moore. So the point I'm making is Hold on. This is my point, everybody. The point I'm making is this. I think we should put Tim Tebow in there. I think he can make plays. That's the thing with Tim Tebow. He can make plays. Not what he's necessarily with his arm. You know, he's not. We know that. We know that. He's not an accurate guy, and he can barely make the throws.
That's pretty much the Sanchez. That's pretty much, you know, that team's divided and everything. I mean, saying that, you know, he's the guy. Well, how's it going to look with Mark Sanchez? You know, you benched him. And he's supposed to be your guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Tim Tebow has played this year. Why does everybody act like he hasn't been in at all? He's been in.
But he hasn't played a series, Mike. He hasn't played a series, Mike. I put him in there because they need. The point I'm making is the Jets are not making plays right now at the quarterback position, and you need somebody to put in there that can make plays. And Tim Tebow's that guy. Tim Tebow can make plays.
They don't really have too many playmakers on the offense though either. I mean,
exactly.
I know a couple of
guys. But my point is, Tim Tebow can make the plays. Tim Tebow can make plays.
Oh,
35.
Oh,
let's see what some callers have to say about this. I want 850. Oh, what you have to say?
Man, this is like really out of control right here. And the thing about it is that you got to look at it. I pretty much look at it in two ways. One, Tebow's pretty much quote-unquote performance in Denver last season and how the Jets pretty much set it up for Tebow this season. And the reason why I say that is you look at the personnel for the New York Jets this season, and it isn't even nothing close in those 2 years when Mark Sanchez pretty much took the Jets to the AFC Championship those 2 years. It's not even close. You don't have that Flacco burst by receiver that can go up and get the deep ball. You had San Antonio Holmes, but now with his foot pretty much shot up, you don't have that anymore, so you got to rely on a Jeremy Curley to go down the field to get those passes. And then you got Sean Green, who can't even average 3 yards a carry in the backfield. So that pretty much shoots down your whole offense. So, yeah, if you put Tebow in, yes, that changes your offensive scheme. Will it be successful? Who knows? But that means that your defenses have to adjust to the run-based offense that will happen when Tebow is on the field. On the plus
side,
when he was in Denver, that's what the opposing teams pretty much had to adjust to. And not only that, but, and I saw this on NFL Live when they had Brian Dawkins on there, and they asked the question on, since they had Tebow out there, what did you think about as a defense? They knew that they had to step up because it was going to be a run. It was going to be a control offense, time of possession type of game, because they knew that they weren't going to throw the ball up and down the field. I mean, you see the scores. They had 17-10, 17-13, 7-3. those type of games. And then you bring up that Pittsburgh playoff game. Remember, one of the Pittsburgh defensive backs was out because he can't play in Denver, period. He can't step in there because the last time he did, he almost died. That's why he didn't even play against Denver this season. So once you have that in the play, when they pretty much had three passes that went for over 30 or 40 yards in that playoff game on that same side where that guy's supposed to be playing at, that's a problem. So now you got to think about, okay, they brought in the guy, the Jets I'm talking about, they brought in the guy that pretty much specialized in Wildcat offense. What is that all about? And then you have an offensive playbook that doesn't pretty much catered to Mark Sanchez's needs because you don't even have the personnel out there to begin with. Looks like a setup to me. So I'm like this. Hey, you can bring Tebow in, he could be successful or whatever it is, but he's not a quarterback, period.
All right. Okay, let me put you on hold. Let me hear what...
Can I say this? The worst first-round pick is Akili Smith. He was a bust.
I
think Tebow over him.
I would take Achilles right now over Tim Tebow.
All right, let me put you on hold, and let me get the next caller in, 813-409.
All right, I'm going to keep this short for you gentlemen this time.
Oh, no.
You asked two questions, and I'm going to answer them both real quick. Who was worse in the first round? Forget first round. What about first pick? Jamarcus Russell. That nigga sucked.
Wow.
He was the worst quarterback I've ever seen in my life. and he was worse than Tim Tebow. Now, to the question of should Tebow get a chance, give white Jesus a chance. Come on.
Wow. Wow.
Hey, also I want to mention this. We're also talking about two SEC quarterbacks, too, by the way. Don't forget that. I just want to add that in. Best defense in country.
Russell had a guy given ability. He just didn't put it together. He had the size and the arm, though. He didn't put it together.
Excuses. The nigga sucked.
All right, we don't need to say that now, the N-word here on the show now, please. Okay, we got kids listening.
Okay,
Tony Wiley,
but the Negro sucked. Does that make you feel better?
Yeah, well, I mean, he wasn't good. Let's just put it that way. Now, in regards to Tim Tebow, you think we should give Tim Tebow a chance, right, Tony Wiley? That's what you're saying?
Without a doubt. I mean, I don't like Tim Tebow, but come on, Mark Sanchez is looking horrible. That nigga I can't say the N-word. But the man looks like he has just lost all his confidence. And if he ain't got no confidence, sit him on the bench and let him see how not starting feels, and maybe that'll spark something in him. But until it does, let white Jesus do his thing.
Okay, who's the third-string quarterback of this young New York Jets?
Alabama.
I would give McElroy a chance before, or I think it's McElroy, but I would give him a chance before Tim Tebow.
But ain't McElroy out though? Isn't he hurt though?
McElroy is hurt. But the point is, I'm gonna put you on hold, Tony Wiley. I got another caller in. The thing is, the point I'm making is Tebow can make plays. That's what the Jets need right there. They need somebody that can make plays. Tebow has that ability, so that's why I think they should start him.
You're looking at what he did in Denver, though. Hold on. Look at what he did.
Well, I mean, I don't see why not. It was last year.
He had Demaryius Thomas to throw the ball to. Excellent wide receiver.
Demaryius Thomas wasn't nothing before Tim Tebow came to the picture. He wasn't nothing before Tim. He was nothing before Tim Tebow got there. You
got
to admit that now, Tex.
He was rejuvenated.
Yeah, because of Tim Tebow.
No.
Thomas was a rookie last year, Clausell.
Say it again?
No.
Thomas was a rookie last year, wasn't he?
No, Demaryius Thomas was not a rookie last year. Demaryius Thomas, that was his second or third year in the league.
Let me get to the call here.
We're running out of time here. Let me get to the call here real quick.
But he did have a terrible quarterback in Orton, though. Orton was a...
Mike. 813-784.
Yo.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
That's good, man.
Y'all being serious? Y'all know the key to this drama is Rex Ryan. He's a drama queen. That's why I bring in Tebow, not because he's a quality quarterback or he's going to make any plays. Bring it in for the media hype. If he could have had HBO come undercover and watch him two seasons in a row, they would have just made a series out of it called... He wants his own Soprano series. That's what it is. Let's be real here. Tim Tebow, and not in any league, not the CFL, not the UFL, not the USFL, not the Midget Football League, none of that. He is not a quarterback. If he wants to switch over like Cordell Stewart did earlier in his career and go over to wide receiver or become an H-back or something like that, it'll be more conducive to his career. Unless he wants to stick to GQ and Us Weekly and stuff like that. Put in Mark Sanchez and look for a quarterback next year. That's what the Jets need to do. The season's done.
Well, my thing is, okay, if the season's done, the point I'm making is, why don't you just let him give him a shot? Because the season was done last year in Denver, okay, and he rejuvenated the team. They lost to New England. They got blown out now. But you can't deny the fact that he rejuvenated that team. He did do that. We all got to admit that. Be real.
They had Elvis Dumerville. They had Von Miller. They were never a bad team, man.
Why don't we just get Mark Wahlberg and make another Disney movie, too, while we're at it?
Well, the point I'm making is this. I'm just saying, I put him in there. I put Tim Tebow in there because he can make plays. Is he accurate? No. We all know that.
Because he sells you.
Can he make off?
That's why I put him in.
Well, that too. Can he make all, can he make all the throws? But when the game's on the line, does he deliver? Yes, that's the key.
Oh, stop
that's
there.
Why you need
that's
to put
brainwash.
Him in there.
You're trying to brainwash it.
How am I not trying to brainwash it? You see, you look at the tape. A lot of tapes. Hold on. I'm about to put you on hold, Matt, man. I got to get to this call here.
All right.
We can't do the, we won't do the two-minute segment tonight because we got to get these calls in. 813.
Also,
813.
Receiver, he's not too bad either.
Hold on. 813.
Me?
Yes.
Come on now. All I'm saying is give Tebow a chance. Give the man a chance. I mean, we all know he sucks. But that's all they got right now. And if that's all they got, let's watch the soap opera. Don't we like to watch train wrecks? Let's watch the train wreck.
Okay. All right. Oh, I'm going to put you back on. I'm going to pose this next question here. Okay. Let's say real quick, okay, and I'm going to get to these calls, but real quick, let's pose this question here. Let's say they put Tim Tebow in because it looks like that's going to happen, all right? What will the Jets do? What will their record be starting with you, Tex?
Oh, man, sub five. Wait. Sanchez gives his team the best chance to win. He wasn't horrible the other night. His wide receivers just didn't make the plays. I mean, come on, man. Tebow completes 45% of his passes. He goes 2-13 for 50 yards or something like that.
The point I'm making is he's not accurate. No, we all know that. He probably can't make the throws.
The first thing he just said, he became a quarterback. Keep going,
but when the game's on the line, he delivers. You got to admit that. He does, man. So, okay, all right. We got your answer real quick. We don't have that much time left. We got your answer, Tex. What's your answer to that? What happens if he starts, Cali Mike? What do you think?
If Tim Tebow starts for the New York Jets, everybody will be fired. First of all, I believe, like the caller said, this whole Tebow thing is a stunt. You have a team at the New York Jets who you feel is a championship-worthy team. They just need a couple more pieces, and the main piece you brought in is Tim Tebow. Come on now. How is that helping the team? Think about it. The whole offseason, who did they bring in? Tim Tebow. Who did they draft? Stephen Hill, a wide receiver from Georgia Tech, they produced Calvin Johnson. But name him a Georgia Tech wide receiver. I mean, come on. He came from a triple option. Come on now. And
all
we got
to move on here. Shottown, Tim Tebow starts. What happens?
Oh, man, I kind of think with Cali Mike, the staff, there's going to definitely be some scrutiny, but I think Rex keeps his job. But if Tim Tebow starts, they're not going to win the game. They can pretty much say, man, and Tony said, it's going to be drama, man. I mean, I agree with Tex. Mark Sanchez gives the Jets the best chance of winning. You know, like I said, I agree. I've seen the highlights of that. Mark Sanchez didn't play a bad game. I mean, they only lost by 6 points, and the guy didn't catch the ball. It was deflected, and that was the game.
I'll say this.
I know Tim Tebow wouldn't have made that throw. I mean, if he was in that game against the Texans, that game might have been ugly.
All right. We're going to get to the caller here. These last few calls here. Real quick, 850, what happens if Tim Tebow? Yeah, real quick, got 90 seconds left. Real quick, what happens, 850, if Tim Tebow starts?
Well, if they do it right now, they might get into a losing record. They're 2-3. They're only a game back in the division. But right now they have New England, Miami, and the NFC West with good defenses. So you're going to be pretty much struggling against those teams in the next 6 or 7 games. And I don't see a winning record coming out of that if they put Tim Tebow in. So their best chance is Lee Sanchez. He didn't have much of a problem going against the Houston Texans a couple of days ago. So that's what I got on that. So I'm out.
All right. Thank you. 813, real quick. What happens if 813-784, what happens if Tim Tebow starts? Real quick. Less than 20 seconds. You there? 813-784.
Oh, I'm here. They losing record. Steven Sanchez.
All right. Thank you. All right, real quick, last but not least.
What's your take, Lazell, on it then, since you asking us?
I think they'll win some games. 813.
I think if they start Tim Tebow, they had a real good chance of winning the New York State High School Championship.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank everybody for listening tonight. CMT Firestorm. You can go to Blog Talk Radio and get the archive of the show. We'll be here next week, same time, same place, 8:30. Have a wonderful afternoon. Peace.
Yeah. I know Willie Joe name, if they like the idea of them getting T-Bow, Broadway Joe.
If they start Tim Tebow, they'll lose to Miami. I mean, the Miami Hurricane.
Soul timers, do you remember the names like Bronco McGurkey and Night Train Lane? Bulldog Turner, my man Sam Huff, in the snow and the mud, they were still real tough. Crazy Leg Church, and remember Raymond Berry asked me if they hit hard, and I say Berry, Paul, Christian, Buddy, Young Lenny Moore, it's them I adore, they seem to always score. Ed Sprinkle, defensive end for those years, Gene Big Daddy Liston was the man to fear. You have Steve Van Buren and Otto Graham, Johnny United had the arm of a superman. We had Charlie Trippi and Gino Marquette. If you're searching for a champion, they're your best bet, which I could quarterback like Johnny Lou Jack or even Sid Luffin. As a matter of fact, do you remember Red Brains, the Galloping Ghost? He could do a 95 running coast to coast. You had Norm Van Brocklin, a real great player, so swift with his moves that he could be mayor. Y.A. Tino, Allie Madison, hey, I remember all those guys from back in the day.
It's the sport of kings, better than diamond rings. That's why we're here to sing football. Sunday in the snow, referees whistle blows, weekend warriors toe to toe. Football, 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 football.